In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman. Wonder Woman. Batman. Aquaman. And those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And joining me this episode is my super friend, Russell Burbage. Hi, Russell.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
I'm doing great. So happy to have you here in the Hall of Justice.
I'm happy to be here.
We're here to talk about, of course, this is the sixth episode, so we're here to talk about Super Friends number six, The Menace of the Menagerie Man. But before we get to the comic, I mean, Russell, you have a, for, I mean, I already kind of know your history with the Super Friends, but for those of you who don't, people who don't know, you have a kind of more personal connection to this comic book than most of us. Why don't you explain that?
Well, I think you're talking about the fact that I, in my youth, would send letters to various DC Comics, and I sent one letter in particular to this book, and it was printed. It was not this issue, but a couple years later, 80s, I think. And yeah, I also, there was a letter from Jeffrey Scott that he was the producer or one of the producers of the Super Friends cartoon show, and he said, oh, we're doing all these wonderful things with the show, and if you want to, you know, let me know what you think of the show or send me a letter. And his California address was printed in the column. And I sent him a letter and he sent me back a illustrated, you know, a Xerox copy of a Alex Toth layout of one of the episodes. And I have that. I treasure it and I will scan it someday and send it to you so you can we can talk about it maybe in another episode. But, yeah, it's awesome. I loved the Super Friends as a kid and I loved the book and I've got Super Friends stuff all sitting in front of me as I'm talking to you about this book. That is
just amazing. I sent letters in as well. I never got anything printed. I had my name, just my name, printed in a Justice League comic once, and just that was so exciting. But to actually, you got letters printed a lot of times. You got letters printed in Justice League, Super Friends. What other, were there other books?
Yeah, some of the world's finest. I remember commenting about when Hawk Girl changed to Hawk Woman. I was a big fan of that, and they printed one of my letters in there. And, of course, I won the Teen Titans letter columns contest.
That's right, yes.
In the Teen Titans book that was canceled one issue later. But I had my foot in that little Teen Titans universe.
You are our own little TM Maple, man. That's just so impressive. That is really yes. Cool. Did you – I mean, were they handwritten, these letters, or did you, like, get your mom or something to type them in? How did that work?
I must have handwritten them because I wasn't a typist until I got into, like, high school. So I must have just printed them clearly. I remember somebody, like Bob Razakis or somebody in one letter column said, hey, here's your hints on how to get your letter printed, you know, write it clearly, put your name on, you know, both sides if it's more than one page, and you don't do this, that, and the other. And I remember following that for, you know, a couple times and trying to be succinct and clear and not just writing it and saying, I love Aquaman. Why don't you use it more in your comic?
That's what I wrote.
I think I did actually write. Well, when we get to our specific Super Friends letter, that is one of my comments was, you know, Aquaman wasn't on the cover. You could have drawn everybody smaller and fitted him in. That was what I said. So
that is awesome. Yeah, we are going to be getting – there will be an episode further down the line where we get to the issue with Russell's letter. We'll be covering that. But for now, we're here to talk about Super Friends number six. As I said, it's the Menace of the Menagerie Man. It's, of course, by E. Nelson Bridwell, Ramona Fraiden, Bob Smith. It was on sale May 26, 1977. Russell, did you get the Super Friends comic every month? Did you get it right from the get-go and all the way till the end, or did you come in later or what?
No, I was there from the beginning, I commented on your number four, I think, was one that I just could not find. But besides that one Riddler issue, I had the whole run. And this particular issue I remember distinctly buying at the grocery store. And I don't know if I missed or it took a long time to get the next issues, but this one is literally, you know, trashed. It has clearly been read and reread and even copied over, you know, that scene of the Super Friends on the cover, them all sort of standing there dramatically. I must have used that as a trace because this comic has been loved.
Oh, that's good. That's the best kind of way to treat your comic book. So, all right, awesome. Well, so the story of the Menace of the Menagerie Man is as follows. During the middle of a basketball game at the Gotham Gardens, a strangely dressed man named the Menagerie Man suddenly appears on the court demanding the valuables of the crowd. He threatens them with an attack by various savage animals that he somehow manages to conjure seemingly out of thin air. Attending the game are Wendy and Marvin, and Wendy activates her signal bracelet, calling the nearby Batman to the scene. But before the Dark Knight can apprehend him, the Menagerie Man disappears along with his animals. Marvin notices a loose dog on the court, but Batman is focused on the wild animals he just saw. Wendy summons the rest of the Super Friends to the Hall of Justice, and along for the ride is the Atom. Suddenly, Commissioner Gordon appears on the trouble alert, telling the Super Friends that the Menagerie Man has struck again. Marvin spots that same dog at the scene, and Batman admits that Marvin was right. The pooch obviously has something to do with this case. The Super Friends think up some likely places the Menagerie Man will strike next, so they split up to be there ahead of him. The Atom, Wendy, and Marvin end up being right, and the Menagerie Man appears at the Palace of Gems. After taking on the Menagerie Man, the Atom sees that the villain isn't teleporting at all. He's using a shrinking ray just like his. The Menagerie Man shrinks himself down to fit into the pouch around the neck of the dog seen at the earlier heists and takes off. Back at the Hall of Justice, the Atom surmises that the Menagerie Man is using material from the same white dwarf star that gives him his powers. The Super Friends then deduce that the Menagerie Man will strike at the ivory exhibit. Soon, they are waiting for him to show up. He does and conjures some walruses as a threat. Unfortunately for the Menagerie Man, Aquaman is there to telepathically command them to turn on the Menagerie Man, leading him to switch out elephants and hippos. The Super Friends subdue the animals, and Menagerie Man tries to disappear like he did before. Wonder Dog is there to get in a scrap with the Menagerie Man's dog, and when the man comes flying out of the dog's pouch, the Atom is there to deliver the knockout blow. Back at the Hall of Justice, the Atom explains that it took the Menagerie Man years to learn how to control the powers bestowed by the White Dwarf Star, which is why he only recently appeared on the scene. He also reveals that this case was the, quote, final exam for Wendy and Marvin, and they passed with flying colors. They are now officially Super Friends. So, Russell, okay, let's start with this cover. It's got this all-green cover you mentioned. It's got a group shot of the entire group of Super Friends. Robin is missing his glove for some reason. You've got the Menagerie Man standing there, and he says, "Back, Super Friends, one step closer, and my pets will destroy the Atom." And there's a gorilla drooling at the sight of the Atom in his claws there. What do you think of this cover?
Well, you know, you could be in the Superman movie.
I could have been. It's very exciting.
I always like this cover. I like the color. I think Menagerie Man's purple makes me think of the Phantom.
Oh, yeah. It is.
And Tarzan. You know, he's got that leopard skin thing going on. So I kind of like the whole look. I imagine Robin saying something like, "Gloves are off," you know, or something, because he's ready to pounce him. I noticed that of the six or seven issues that Wendy and Marvin are in, they are on every cover.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Superman, and so is Wonder Woman. And the other guys kind of swing in and out. But mm-hmm. Wendy and Marvin and Wonder Dog are on every cover. So that's kind of cool. And Wonder Dog looks like he's about to, you know, attack the gorillas or the chimpanzees or the tiger. It's funny that if you have dogs – you know that if they see a wild animal or something, they tend to not stand there. They tend to, you know, react. So I'm amazed that Wonder Dog is not jumping in and attacking the tiger or the chimpanzees. He's clearly a wonder.
He's very well trained. One of the things I noticed about this cover, other than, of course, like you said, Robin is missing a glove, is the logo. Because, of course, the famous Super Friends logo, you've got these letters, and then the background of them, or the dimension, sort of go off into the background.
Right.
But the logo to previous issues was always cut off. before it got too far. But here it goes. You can see how far the logo extends. It goes all the way back, and it's only because you have the menagerie man with his arm out that it doesn't go back even further. I mean, it really just goes all the way back. And I'm like, whoever drew that logo, I guess, I don't know if it was like one of the, you know, I'm sure it was one of the in-house DC letterers, Todd Klein or like Gaspar Saladino or Milt Schnappen or one of these guys. But I mean, it's sort of funny to think that they drew that out that far, that it extended that far. And then, you know, having done perspective in my life, that's a giant pain in the ass.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I will say the Menagerie Man's costume, while yes, it does look like the Phantom, it is kind of a mess, really, because you've got this purple tunic. He's got this handlebar mustache. He's got a big M on his chest, plus the leopard skin tunic, plus a kind of Batman-esque utility belt, plus shorts, and then a purple boots. It really is. It is one of, I would say, Ramona Frayn's more silly designs, but I think it's, you know, sort of supposed to be.
Well, it's funny that he comes back and he has a different costume when he comes back.
Does he come back?
Yeah, twice.
Oh my God, I didn't know that. I've read all these issues. I must have forgotten that. Well, that'll look forward to seeing the Menagerie Man again. It's very exciting. So, all right, well, very cool. So on the inside splash, it's kind of a similar scene where it's Menagerie Man and the chimpanzees and the tiger, and you've got them all. And then it's a special guest star, the Atom, which is very nice. I like Superman is – He kind of has his arms around Wendy and Marvin, like he's sort of holding them back a little. And when you've said Wonder Dog again is kind of like, and so like, okay, it's very exciting.
Well, you can see that Robin has dashed off to find his other glove.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Robin is gone. That's right. We don't see Robin there. They do make room for the little inset saying special guest star, the Atom. So like you said, it opens up. The opening scene is at the Gotham Gardens where we've got the initial robbery. I love Wendy's signal bracelet with all the icons around her around her wrist. I wish they had made that. I would have bought that as a kid. I mean, I didn't wear jewelry, but I would have bought that to have like a little bat symbol and an Aquaman A. That would have been boss.
This is the debut of her magic signal bracelet. If you remember, last time she was captured by the greenback guy, she didn't have anything. She had a pen and paper.
That's right.
Maybe I'm thinking Batman and Wonder Woman looked at her and said, you need some sort of alarm system, so a signaler or something. So they gave her this bracelet. I wonder if Marvin had anything, because we never saw that he had a watch, a signal watch for Jimmy type of thing that he could have used.
I think they trust Wendy with it more than anything else. But yeah, it's a really cool little item.
Yeah, it's nifty.
Yeah, I like in that very next panel, too. Where she, you know, sets off the signal device and she contacts Batman, and we see Batman entirely in silhouette. And Ramona Frayden, as much as I love her work, and we all love her work, is not known for her moodiness in her work. But that's actually a pretty moody panel. It's just this silhouette of Batman flying in front of the moon, and then there's the reflection of him on the surface of a building. It's a really kind of a cool little, Dark Knight kind of thing. It's moodier than what you expect from Ramona Frayden.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the reasons I always like Ramona Frayden is she never really got the attention she deserved. She was really good at conveying the sense of the story. And she was doing, the panel probably said, Wendy, reaches for her bracelet, Batman swings down. And she draws it, illustrates it this way. That's cool. It's really well done.
Yeah. I like the scene. I've said Batman takes on the cheetahs that the Menagerie Man brings forth, and he's relatively nice to them. He even says this should keep you out of the fracas, Kitty. And he says, I don't want to hurt you, but I'd rather you play with your master, which I like. I like that Batman realizes, they're not they're wild animals, but they're not evil or anything. So I like that. I like that he's he's like, I have to subdue them, but I don't want to hurt them, which always, as an animal lover, that appeals to me very much.
Yeah.
He wants to be nice to them. And then they go back to the Hall of Justice. We get the appearance by the Atom, which is always exciting because, we didn't get to see Ramona Frayden draw that many different superheroes. So I always love it when somebody from the Justice League shows up. I always thought that was really cool. And of course, he's got his story in the beginning where he's like, you guys helped us defeat the World Beater, so I'm here to repay the debt, which is, it works for now.
Yeah, well, you skipped over one of my least favorite bits, though. It's when Marvin says, hey, there's a dog. And Batman says, shut up, kid. You don't know what's wrong.
He literally says, who cares?
Right.
We're worried about this wild beast, not a team pooch.
Right. I have this huge note saying that's rude and Batman, that's not like Batman. He would be like, if this was the TV show, he would have said, well, now, Marvin, we have more important things to worry about. You know, cheetahs are more dangerous than wild dogs, or, you know, something stupid. But he says, who cares? And I thought right away, ooh, what happened?
That is a fairly atypical line of dialogue for Batman. Who cares? I don't think he ever says that, really. When I got to that part in the story, I was like, really? Batman says, okay, all right.
Yeah, and you can see Marvin's kind of pissed. He's like, okay, fine, whatever.
He does have kind of slightly just faces a little scrunched. He's a little like, all right, okay. And then even later on in the next page, when Wendy says, that doesn't explain if a menagerie man's belt is made of compartments, sort of like Batman's utility belt. And then Marvin looks even madder, and he says, I still think that big dog had something to do with it. So he's really pissed off.
Yeah.
So we get an appearance by Commissioner Gordon, which is always fun. I like the shot that they have of the Menagerie Man attacking the Big Dipper nightclub, and we see this chaos, and we literally see a bear pulling a fur off of like some rich lady. That's just like a funny image. Yeah. There's like punch flying and all sorts of stuff. It's like that just looks really funny. Like this bear using both his hands to pull the fur off this lady.
Yeah, it's adorable, but also dangerous because bears are not, you know, teddy bears.
No, it's very dangerous. Yeah. And then so it's that same page where Batman says, look like you were right after all. And Marvin looks very happy. He's got his hands on his hips.
Yeah.
And he's like, and Wendy says, I have to admit, great detecting, Super Marv.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. And then they said they all split up. They just said, like, very Gardner Fox. They all decided to head to different locations to see where the Menagerie Man is going to show up. They go to the Palace of Gems, which, of course, this is, you know, Gotham always has places like this. The Atom appears. I didn't mention in the synopsis, but he temporarily loses his size changing powers, where he's in Atom form, and then the Menagerie Man touches something. And then he shrinks down. He shrinks, returns to his normal size as Ray Palmer touches his controls. It goes back to the Atom, and he's like, "Well, I don't even know why that happened." And they'll explain later. And he gets a shot in at the Menagerie Man, and then Menagerie Man shrinks and tries to disappear with the dog. So there's that whole sequence. Then they go back to the Hall of Justice, and then we get a origin sequence. We get a full on like 2-page origin sequence of the Atom. As drawn by Ramona Freyden, which I thought was a nice little bonus I get for kids who maybe don't exactly know who this character is. I was like, this is cool. I like that the story sort of stops for a moment to just recap the origin.
I like that, and I always kind of liked the Atom as a third tier character, and the appearance of one of the Justice Leaguers here to participate, and we find out later to kind of monitor, is a great idea. But this whole thing, it's like, hold on. How contrived, how coincidental can you be that you've got the same powers as this brand new bad guy, and now you're going to explain it to us so we all understand how conveniently it is that you happen to be Johnny on the Spot? I thought, okay, Nelson Bridwell, your plotting is a little weak here.
The truth doesn't have to make sense, Russell. It doesn't have to be believable. It's just the truth.
I guess.
So, yeah. And then you said, I like that. It's the idea that it's like, well, the Menagerie Man got a hold of the same White Dwarf Star material, and there's this sort of question of like, well, then why is he just appearing now? And they will get to that in a moment. So then they all go to the ivory exhibition, the Danbury Gallery. Aquaman gets a line of dialogue where he says, yes, since ivory comes from animals. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, it does, Aquaman. It's a moment from a different time, because now, of course, an ivory exhibit would be deemed, you know, horrific. You know, nobody's having ivory exhibits anymore. But back then, it was maybe we were not quite as sophisticated, and it was like, you know, the way Aquaman says ivy comes from animals just sounds much more benign than it really is. Like, yeah, it comes from them the way meat does. I mean, you know, it's like it doesn't. It's not like you're milking a cow. It's you actually had to rip these things off these poor animals. So we go to the ivory exhibit, and there's an inadvertently, I think, sort of funny panel. And it's at the bottom where all the super friends are laying in wait for the Menagerie Man. And Superman and Batman are literally laying on top of a curio cabinet, which is like really like they're trying so hard not to be noticed. But it's kind of noticeable to have 2 6-foot guys in capes laying on top of one of the cases. Like it just looks good. It looks a little undignified for the two of them, I have to say.
Well, but nobody seems to notice them. So
no, it worked. Well, Batman is, of course, a master at, you know, disappearing into the shadows. We see Aquaman staying off to the side and Wonder Woman's in a doorway. And then it said the Menagerie Man shows up. Now, I have to say, would conjuring some walruses really instill enough fear that you would hand over your valuables? I mean, I know walruses can be dangerous, but it's not exactly the most fearsome animal he could have brought up.
No, but they each weigh a good, you know, couple of tons each. So if you don't clear out, perhaps my tusked friends can persuade you. So, you know, kind of like, you know, a barking dog or something would be sufficiently scary to certain people.
They're going to come after you very slowly.
Well, but they turned on the Menagerie Man pretty quick.
They do. Well, they do. And that's Aquaman gets a nice moment where the
– I do. Yeah, I love this part.
Yeah, I like when he says, back, blessed you. Oh, baby. And Aquaman comes out of the shadows and says, forget it. Walruses are sea creatures. Therefore, they follow my mental instructions, which I like. It's Aquaman. Yeah. Anytime Aquaman gets something special to do, I always appreciate it. And then Menagerie Man gets rid of the walruses, immediately conjures up some elephants and some hippos. And that's when we get a nice shot of all the super friends taking care of the animals. I would say Superman and Wonder Woman are maybe a little rough. Like, Wonder Woman is literally throwing one elephant on the ground by the tusk, which is a little mean. Superman is a little nicer. He says, sorry, Jumbo, but we have to keep you quiet. Aquaman knocks over a hippo, where he talks about his muscles accustomed to the pressures at great depths, which is the same line he had from the previous issue. So two issues in a row, he's restated his powers. And then Robin gets a line, which is deeply offensive to this Aquaman fan. Because they're
with you.
Yeah, they're hog-tying a hippo. And what does Robin say, Russell?
Our bat ropes are as strong as you, Aquaman.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I cry bullshit. I mean,
bullshit. No, Robin, now, damn it, that's not – come on. I didn't like that at all. But okay, all right, he's just a kid. So the Menagerie Man jumps into the little pouch that the pooch carries around, and that's when Wonder Dog finally comes into the scene. It's kind of what you talked about, that Wonder Dog's been waiting. He actually bites the leg of the dog. We see it in the middle panel. There's a snap in the ground. We literally see them with each other's paws in their mouth, which is, you know, a little – if you've ever had two dogs fight, it's actually pretty horrific.
Yes, yes. This is a very cartoony version of a dog fight. But
yeah.
I like to call him the Menagerie Mutt. I don't know what his real name is. But Wonder Dog battles him and gets the prize, the Menagerie Man collar. And then Adam is able to sweep in and punch his lights out.
Nice work, Wonder Dog. I'll take care of him. He has been taken. And then he knocks him out.
Yeah.
And then we go back to the Hall of Justice. And we talk about that Adam reveals that this whole thing was essentially a test. I mean, obviously it was a real case, but it was they were brought on because it was a test. And he says they have passed with flying colors. And, you know, even Wendy is like, we didn't do anything. And the Adam says, wrong. You spotted the most important clues before the Super Friends, and you trained Wonder Dog to stop the supervillain's escape. And it ends with all of them shaking hands of Wendy and Marvin. And so they have now officially graduated. And what do you think about that?
I thought that was adorable. I liked the idea. By the time this issue came out, I think the new show had started or there'd been ads on TV or something for the new Super Friends. So I knew that Wendy and Marvin were leaving, and it makes sense for them to prove their worth. I mean, I know a lot of people think Wendy and Marvin are terrible characters, but in general, if you read these 5-6 issues and you watch the show, they did pull their, shall I say, teenage weight. I mean, they weren't totally useless characters. And this is a good example of Marvin has been trained to notice things, and he notices things and points them out before Batman does. So that's huge. I mean, he's right up there with Robin. So I liked it. And I liked the idea of them moving on. And I'm kind of sad that they never really came back to the series at all as, you know, a little older and wiser super friends.
Yeah. Not a whole lot much was really done with them at this point after that. I know Chris Franklin was happy about that, but generally, yeah, they were sort of retired at that point, which is – it is kind of a shame because, like I said, I like Wendy and Marvin. I like that there's a distinction between the junior super friends who don't have powers. I think having the Wonder Twins have superpowers to me blurs the distinction a little bit. And I just – I don't know. I always found Zan kind of annoying, I guess, the way, again, Chris Franklin finds Marvin. But yeah, they graduated. It is a sweet moment. I like that they brought the Adam in. That's fun, and it's a nice little thing. So it's a nice ending, and it talks about how they're going to introduce some new super friends, Zan, Jaina, and Gleek, in the next issue. So for as much as this comic book was all typically kind of one and dones or two and dones, or in some cases three and dones, but I mean, each issue was supposed to kind of almost like a sitcom. Like the characters were the same in the beginning to the end. This is actually character development. We're actually moving forward with some of these characters, which is nice. The idea that these are trainees, at some point they do need to graduate or something's gone wrong. And so that is a cool moment.
Yeah, I think it was well handled. And I think either this issue or soon, E. Nelson Bridwell said something about that they were really difficult to write as just kind of like the snapper car type, you know, third person, you know, third party like observers, but they had to actually also do something. So it was hard for them to be written into the story, which I can appreciate. They didn't really do anything in this story except, you know, point out some things and then train their dog. So, I mean, I understand that part. But, you know, Robin doesn't do anything until the very end, and he needs Batman's help to tie up the hippo. They're almost as good as Robin.
There you go. Now, on the letters page, generally, the letters are coming in. They're starting to become a little more positive towards the Super Friends book. I will say someone named Dean Larson suggests that other guest stars should appear, like Plastic Man, Supergirl, Batgirl, and Zatanna the Magician. Some of them would appear, some would not. There is a letter from someone named John Pierce who says, in quotes or in parentheses, "But Ramona needs to learn how to draw Hawkman." Screw you, John Pierce. Ramona Frayn does not know how to learn how to draw anybody. She was great from the beginning. So I don't know what he's talking about. She did a great job. That one thing jumped out of me. I'm like, how dare you? How dare you say anything bad about Ramona Frayn, Mr. Pierce? I don't know what's your problem.
I met Ramona Frayn a couple of years ago at the New York Comic Con, and we chatted for a while about comics and her history with the Super Friends in particular. And she said that she enjoyed doing this series, but she eventually got tired of it because E. Nelson Bridwell would never really print any letters about how from people who liked her art.
Oh,
and I thought, my God. Wow, I guess if you put in criticisms like this, now I'm going to be hyper, you know, sensitive about, do the letters say that her art sucks? It doesn't, that doesn't any here except for that one bit, but I guess.
I'm going to have to pay attention to that in subsequent episodes because
he's
a shame. Oh man,
it is a shame. And she also did not like Vince Coletta. Of course, I've heard most people don't like his work. She really liked Bob Smith, who is her anchor.
He's a great anchor for her.
Yeah, they did a great job. They were on it for like, you know, 20 issues in a row or something. So
yeah. I think he inked her across other series too. I think he inked her on Plastic Man when she did that as well, I believe. Oh. So yeah, he was a great anchor for her. That's a shame. That's a real shame. Yeah, I'm going to be hyper vigilant about looking for these people knocking Ramona Frayn. I mean, I love this work. I think it's just so gorgeous. So well, that's overall, that's the issue. Super Friends number 6, The Menace of the Menagerie Man. So Russell, I have to ask you the questions I ask of every episode. So who do you think was of the Super Friends? Who's the best friend? Who do you think came out the best of all the heroes in this issue?
I don't know. Is it okay for me to say the Atom? I mean, because
that was my choice as well.
He got the majority of the attention in this issue. If he got his own origin recapped, he's on like every other page. He did most of the work.
Yeah, but, I mean, the book. Yes, he is absolutely the star of this one. He gets his origin recapped. He gets to do a bunch of fun stuff. It's the Menagerie Man is sort of his villain in a loose way. So yeah, no, absolutely, he is. They definitely gave him a lot to do in this issue. So yeah, I would absolutely agree. He is the best friend in this issue for the villain roundup. Okay. The Menagerie Man, you mentioned to me that he does come back, but he only ever appeared in Super Friends.
Right.
Do you think that the Menagerie Man had enough juice to maybe be part of the larger DCU, or is he sort of relegated to just being a Super Friends villain?
Well, I'm torn because I want to say that he's a great concept. I mean, stop and think about what E. Nelson Bridwell is telling us in this story. This man not only manages to do what the Atom managed to do, so he's some sort of astrophysicist or physicist or something. He's some huge scientist. And he knows how to teach bears how to rip, you know, fur shawls off of rich women. So there's got to be a backstory to this guy. Really wish the story had ended at like page 14 or so when Aquaman, you know, had stopped the walruses. So we could have gotten a little bit more intro onto his backstory. Like, how did he find the white dwarf? Is he an astrophysicist? They say that he works at a zoo. So how the hell does he know how to shrink down stuff and also teach walruses how to attack people? That's mind boggling.
He does have a panoply of abilities, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, plus, he's got the awesome handlebar mustache. He looks really looks like Raleigh Fingers and the Brewers.
He has no fashion sense, but he does have some sort of knowledge of how to commit crimes. I mean, he was getting away with it until the Atom popped up. One of my favorite bits in there was when the Atom shows up at that jewelry store, and he said, "Oh, so you figured it out. Oh, what you would." Like, of course, you know, that he's shrinking. So he knows what's going on. I liked him. This was – I don't want to spoil anything, but this was probably his best appearance. He doesn't get any better.
Okay. I agree. I think the power set could actually have been used in other comics, but he definitely – I am really curious to see what he looks like in subsequent issues, because this outfit would not cut it, I'd say, in a quote-unquote regular DC superheroes comic. It's just too goofy looking. You know, it's just way too comical. But like I said, Ramona Freyden is doing that on purpose. But yeah, I mean, if he had appeared in like a regular Batman comic, it would have been like, what the hell is this guy? You know, but the Atom didn't have his own series at all in the 70s and into the 80s until they did Sword of the Atom. So there was probably no chance of ever making him like an Atom villain, because where else would he have appeared?
Right.
So anyway, it's a fun issue, though. I enjoy it. I mean, again, I like the one and dones, and I like the introducing of a new villain that they have to solve. Aquaman gets a little bit to do, not as much as I would like, but that's always the case. And I'm sure, Russell, you feel the same way. We always want Aquaman to get more to do. But overall, I mean, like I said, I love it when Ramona Freyden gets to draw other members of the Justice League. That's always exciting. And so it was cool to have Adam in this comic. So that is normally where we would wrap it up here. But Russell has asked that he be included in a For All Merch Kind segment. Normally I do that with Chris Franklin, but we are going to do a For All Merch Kind segment right now. So we're here to talk about a fun pieces of Super Friends merch that actually have are very near and dear to my heart. So Russell, why don't you explain what we're going to be talking about?
Well, I have a huge collection of Aquaman related merchandise. And in that is quite a few Super Friends stuff that I started picking up in the late 70s. And what I found when I was thinking about, you know, trying to present something that Chris might not have, I came across the party favors, some party plates and some horn, or I guess it's a horn. Yeah, it's a horn. And a party loot bag that I bought must have been in 1977 or 1978, maybe right around the time that I bought this comic book. What's funny is that at that time, 75, 76, 77, Super Friends was huge, and they had a huge amount of party stuff. If you go into any Target or big box store and go into like the greeting cards area, wrapping paper area, you'll see all of these kids' party favors and party themed plates and cups and things like that. They still sell all of that stuff. And in the 70s, the Super Friends was a huge presence. So they had all of those things. I remember distinctly there were paper cups, there were big plates, there were small plates, there were bowls, there was a paper tablecloth, there's these party horn things, there's these party loot bags. I think there might have been like rings or darts or some toy thingy that you could play with. Well, I was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 at the time. So I was too old for, you know, wanting to have a Super Friends themed party. I mean, God forbid. But they all went on clearance. And as a kid with an allowance, I went and bought like one each of these things to add to my Aquaman collection. And I know that I had the cups for years, but I can't find them. And I think I used the bowls, and I think I used the napkins. And so the only things that I still have in my collection is this party horn. There were five of them. I remember there was Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, and Robin. So there's all five of the main Super Friends, and I kept Aquaman. And then there's party loot bags where you put the gifts, and it has space on there where it says, "This bag belongs to," and it's got the copyright DC Comics 1977. So it must have been right around this time as the comic book. And then the plate is copyrighted 1976, so I don't know if that was an earlier merch or what, but
maybe the loot bag came a little later or something like
maybe.
That.
It's the same classic five pose that they did on the original, the first season cartoon show, you know, with Superman on it with his hands on his hips and Wonder Woman holding her golden lasso and Batman and Robin and then Aquaman with his hands on his hips.
Yep.
By the Hanna-Barbera artist. So yeah, I've managed to keep these things for, you know, 40 some years. Wow.
One of the reasons this I have this stuff too, because one of the reasons I don't have the horn though, but I have the other stuff. I have the plates and the loot bag. And one of the reasons that this is great for Super Friends collectors as well as an Aquaman collector is because Aquaman is all over it.
Yeah.
Unlike other merchandise that we've talked about, he was not removed, and he gets just as much of a play here as the other characters. As you mentioned, it's got the logo. It says Super Friends. Now, this stuff is very near and dear to my heart because there are photos from – yeah, you're familiar with these photos.
I think I've seen them, yes.
You have seen these photos. There are two photos of me. And by the way, you will be able to see pictures of this merchandise, of Russell's merchandise, and these photos that I'm talking about over on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. If you look at the gallery post that accompanies this episode, there are two photos of me up at the Poconos in the mountains, mountain comics, as it were. And it is a picture of me at our kitchen table from my 6th birthday and my 7th birthday. And everything is exactly the same, except I'm a little older, obviously, 1 year older. There's a 7 on the cake instead of a 6, and there's a TIE fighter off to the side. But if you look in the pictures, you will see the Super Friends tablecloth, Super Friends plates, Super Friends cups, Super Friends napkins, and the Super Friends the centerpiece, which
oh,
was
the
like a
centerpiece,
little,
yes.
The centerpiece was a little foam thing and had the five.
Yes.
I mean, I was a creature of habit. I was like, hey, I loved it for my 6th birthday. I'd love it for my 7th birthday. And I have no idea whether my mom threw all this stuff out and then bought it over or kept it. She probably kept it knowing that, you know, this kid's going to love the Super Friends next year, which was entirely correct. So it's amazing that these photos are, I mean, it's in the same room. The same stuff's in the background. There's paper towels, the drapes. Everything stayed the same up in the Poconos. We just went there every August. So these I love these photos because I think probably by the time I turned 8, it was mostly Star Wars. I think that was probably my big thing. I mentioned that there's a TIE fighter on the table. You see me in the seventh birthday picture. I'm wearing a Darth Vader t-shirt. So the Star Wars is already creeping in at that point. But I still love the Super Friends. And, you know, yeah, so these party favors are probably like my most beloved piece of superhero merch in some ways because I have these photos that I just love them so much. There's my mom looking at me, dad, her nerd son. I'm just so excited at this Super Friends stuff. And it's great. I mean, they're for merchandise, for what's supposed to be kind of cheap party merchandise, the graphics are great.
Yes.
You know, like the Aquaman on the horn looks great. It's nice and big, and the plates are really brightly colored. I mean,
yes.
They are really, really sharp.
Yeah.
I love it. It's great, great stuff. And it's, you know, I mean, nowadays, of course, you know, kids can get anything on merchandise if they want. You know, I mean, there's just merchandise up the wazoo, but that was still a little unique back then. So the fact that there was Super Friends merchandise, party favor stuff, it was just so, so very exciting.
Yes, it was very exciting. And nowadays you can actually go to stores that are selling only these sorts of things, you know, like Party Carnival or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But at this time, if you get to Target, which is where I bought this, I'm pretty sure, and you come back like a week later and it's not there anymore. You know, you got that stuff turned over with the fad of the time,
yep.
You know, and I'm guessing that per your experience, some of the Super Friends stuff got clearanced out because of Star Wars and stuff like
that.
The next summer was Star Wars and Battlestar Galactica, and, you know, Super Friends never really came back the way that they had been before.
Yeah, pre-Star Wars, they kind of had an open, you know, an open open space, you know, for pop culture ephemera because there just wasn't that many properties around. But yeah, now that there's so much stuff everywhere. But yeah, I love all this stuff. It made me so happy when you sent me those pictures. Cause I was like, oh, I have all that stuff. It's just really, really cool. So
well, good.
Well, awesome. Well said, Russell, thank you for stopping by. This will be first of at least a few appearances here on For All Mankind. As we talked about, we're going to be covering at least one other issue where you got a letter included. So thank you for stopping by. And why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Well, on the internet, I spend most of my time in the future, the 30th century. I'm on the Legion of Super Bloggers 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We have new posts. And then the chronological review of the Superboy Legion series is every Saturday morning. And then I have my own personal stuff, which is right now I'm reviewing the old Nemesis backup stories from the old 80s Brave and the Bold stories.
Oh, wow.
And that is at I can't think of the American, the English word. I only can remember my Seigi no Nakama. But it's probably a link that Rob will put on the post somewhere.
Absolutely. So we will have the link in the show notes. Absolutely.
Friends of Justice, I think, is what it's called.
There you go. Absolutely. Yeah. So awesome. Again, thank you so much for stopping by. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I want you to stay tuned, stay through these commercial messages. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Welcome to the world of tomorrow!
The Legion of Superheroes through the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, the Baxter series, 5 years later, the reboot, the three-boot, the retro-boot, the animated series. We have banded together as the Legion of Super Bloggers to cover it all. Seek us out at legionofsuperbloggers.blogspot.com.
Always have to say it that way.
Haven't you ever heard of a little thing called showmanship?
We'll return after these messages.
Ever play basketball without any air in the ball?
Because of bounce.
Right. And that's how you can be in the morning if you skip breakfast. You can lose your bounce and start feeling flat and droopy. So fill up with a good breakfast, like cereal and fruit, or eggs and bacon, toast, juice, and milk. Because if you fill up before you start your day, you are giving it your best shot.
This breakfast message brought to you by Kellogg's.
And we're back with the part of the show I like to call Super Fans, where I go over the feedback from the previous episode, which in this case is, of course, For All Mankind number 5 with my guest David Gallagher. But before we get to the comments on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com, we have some new iTunes reviews. It's always so exciting when we have iTunes reviews because, as I mentioned, there are other pieces of entertainment with the same title, For All Mankind, so it really does help particularly this show get noticed when I get some iTunes reviews. So the two new ones that came in. The first one is from Big Ox 737, 5 stars. It says, a podcast for all comic kind. I'm a huge fan of the Fire and Water Network podcast, and this recent entry to their catalog is one of my favorite shows they do. I'm a lifelong comic collector, but the Super Friends comic is one series I never read before, so I get to find out what I missed out on with each episode. Rob and his guests are going through the series issue by issue, and it is wildly entertaining. Rob and guests bring a wonderful mix of history, nostalgia, and their own experiences with the comic to each show. They discuss the creators, characters, synopsis, art, and writing in each episode. There's also a segment where they discuss Super Friends merchandise, which is a great touch. This is a fun podcast that any comic book or cartoon fan will enjoy. Thank you so much, Big Ox. That's a great review. Thank you very, very much. And then the other review we got is also 5 stars from Travy Baby. It says, great podcast on a classic DC Comics title. I love how you're focusing on one issue per episode and really discussing the story details, then looking at the bigger picture, such as the cultural or time period references. This really brings back memories of how much I love this comic series and the TV series. Thanks, and keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Travy Baby. I really appreciate those reviews. That's just warms my heart. So, again, thank you very, very much for those iTunes views. And please, if you want to do the same, if you're listening, go out to Apple Podcasts and leave the show a 5-star review, and I will read it here on the show. All right, so as I mentioned, we're going to get to the comments from the website, but one other email I did want to mention is I got one from Travis Heath, who says, hi there, I wasn't sure if listeners already knew this, but I just wanted to share. The earliest issues of Super Friends are now available digitally on the Comixology or DC app. Thanks, and enjoying the podcast. Thank you, Travis. Yeah, I forgot to point that out. I think like in the last two episodes, that yes, some of the Super Friends comics are now appearing over on Comixology and on the DC app, so you can read them digitally, which is super exciting if you want to catch up on this show. So thank you so much for the kind words, Travis, and taking the time to write me. I really appreciate it. All right, now we're really getting to the comments on the website, FireAndWaterPodcast.com. And again, these are the comments for issue 5 of the show, which I did with David Gallagher. First up is from Wonder Doug Van Diver, who says, David's right. That moment with Marvin levitating is a thing. It's an early installment weirdness thing, to borrow TV Tropes' lingo. Marvin doesn't demonstrate that or any other power thereafter. The cartoon's creative team might have had only a partial accord on whether the junior friends have powers or what their deal is, which, to be fair, is totally understandable. Case in point, the sentient dog. Holy Moses, they used Funny Man in this issue? Kudos for you two for catching that. That reference went right over my head. Well, thank you, Doug, but I have to give all the credit to David for that, for noticing Funny Man. I know of Funny Man, and I know that he was a creation of Jerry Siegel, but I didn't catch the reference in the comic. So that is all on David for catching this. Again, thank you for the comment. Gold Dragon71 says, regarding the coins fired from an air gun, that could actually be fatal. There have been air guns that were used as silent killing weapons, particularly in popular fiction. Sherlock Holmes was endangered in The Final Problem and The Empty House by deadly air gun rifle wielded by Moriarty's associate Colonel Sebastian Moran. Yeah, I think I knew that air guns could be fatal. It just, I guess it's like, I'm not sure that Aquaman would really be taken out by a coin shot at him by an air gun, because I've always believed in the idea that Aquaman is bulletproof. So if he's bulletproof, an air gun's not going to do much, but hitting Robin with it or Batman, that would definitely cause a problem. So I agree with you there, Gold Dragon. Mark Ross, aka Cluck Trent, says, a fun episode. I enjoyed the issue. Thanks to David for sharing the Larry Davis Funny Man tidbits. I'd never heard of any of that before. I love David's enthusiasm for all of it, Marvin aside. I do have to say that I prefer Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog to the Wonder Twins, but I don't think I saw the former as a kid. I don't remember seeing first season episodes until I was an adult. So while the Wonder Twins annoyed me, I discovered and appreciated Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog as an adult who hadn't seen the Super Friends in years. I agree with Rob that the extremely negative letters were ridiculous. Just don't buy the book. The one guy said he didn't like the art of the story, but he's hooked and has become a super fanatic. Very odd. Thanks for the episode. I hope that For All Merch Kind with Chris returns next episode. Well, again, thank you for the comments, Mark. As you heard, yes, the For All Merch Kind segment did return this episode, but not with Chris. But I promise it will be back next episode with Chris. Sean M. Myers, who was a guest on this very show, says, welcome to the show, David. You did a great job with Rob, and it was so nice to have a new episode to listen to while I did my walk jog this morning. You guys talked about Larry Davis, Jeanine Gale, and Wilford Pennyworth on the show, but of course, the glorious ENB wasn't just making up names when he created the guest list for the Superthon. Scott Free is Mr. Miracle, Kathy Kane is Batwoman, Steve Lombard worked with Clark at WGBS, Chip O'Doul sang a hit song called Earthquake Rock in Jimmy Olsen. Deep cut, Sean. Gregory Reed is an actor who is famous for portraying Superman in the movies. Carlo Di Renzi, who we saw perform magic in this show, was a member of the original Secret Six. Oh, I completely missed that one, Sean. Wow, that's a super deep cut. And I read that comic. And Linda Turner was a Harvey superheroine called Black Cat. Truth be told, a few of those I had to look up. Well done, Sean. Wow, I had no idea that that character's from the Secret Six. That's, whew, oh, I love it. That's cool. Thank you so much for all that. Edo Boznar says, I think Robin may have been throwing shade at Wendy on the show because she gets mentioned in the opening sequence and he doesn't. Still not cool, but understandable. Although it probably would have made more sense to take it out on Marvin since, as you noted, Wendy tended to make more useful contributions. As for Greenback's wardrobe change, I think a better look for him would be a green three-piece suit, so he was a kind of gangster vibe. Well, I guess, yeah, then he would look so much like the Riddler in his three-piece suit. But, yeah, I am a fan of the gangster look for criminals. So, yeah, that would have been a nice thing to see if Greenback had ever returned. Chris Franklin from this very network and a guest on this show has this great episode. David brings the knowledge with the Funny Man bit. I am aware of Funny Man, but I never would have guessed it was him because I didn't know his secret identity. All the name drops are pure ENB, even Tony Stark. ENB wrote the Inferior Five, which was constantly lampooning Marvel Comics. In the 60s, he was probably more aware of Marvel than anyone else at DC, who never thought that upstart company could eclipse them in sales. Mm-hmm. Marvin floating in that episode was weird. Did he have powers, or did he have cartoon gravity-defying powers like Wile E. Coyote's ability to walk on air until he realizes he is walking on air? Who can say? If Marvin did have the burgeoning powers, I could accept his placement on the team much better. Wendy is clearly very bright. Wonder Dog is surprisingly useful. Marvel is much better in the comics. Enough said. Nice Marvel reference there, Chris. Thank you. Gothos Mansion says, I like how ENB had Greenback reveal that he didn't want to go to New York to rob Tony Stark. Greenback is a local baddie that doesn't want to travel. Plus, that is a nice way of explaining why Iron Man didn't kick his behind before the super friends got to him. I think I disagree about Batman being friend of the month, or whatever you call it, best friend. I call it best friend, Gothos. He stayed captured almost the entire issue, and Superman allowing Batman to take out Greenback seemed to be kind of a pity capture. You know, Superman was thinking, Wonder Woman and I have done all the real work. Might as well let Batman stroke his ego by catching the bad guy. I know you highfalutin Fire and Water guys like your critically acclaimed comedy dramas like MASH and Cheers, but I think ENB may have been watching one of my favorite shows, The Beverly Hillbillies, when he wrote this issue. Greenback's costume immediately reminded me of an episode that parodied the 66 Batman TV show when Drysdale filmed a commercial where he was super banker. And Gothos provides a photo. He says, the episode is from later in Beverly Hillbillies run when it got pretty hit or miss, and this episode was pretty much a miss, except for the commercial scene where he had Ellie Mae dress in a tater sack, that's potato sack for you Yankees, and a before scene to show how Super Banker had transferred her into a sophisticated lady with a fancy city clothes in an after scene. Damn, Ellie Mae looked good in that tater sack. Gothos goes on, and then he ends the comment with one last comment. Damn, Ellie Mae looked great in that tater sack. Okay, Gothos, I think we've discovered your particular obsessive pop culture corner there. Maybe you should start a show on the Beverly Hillbillies, maybe even here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I think maybe Chris Franco might be in on that with you. I don't know. You'd have to coordinate with him. Liz Ann Oswald says, the villain kind of reminds you of Mr. Drysdale from the Beverly Hillbillies' favorite superhero, Money Man. So, okay, I'm confused now. Was he Money Man or was he Super Banker? I don't know, but it's sort of funny that two of you remembered that and really stuck in your memory. I only watched the Beverly Hillbillies in reruns and even then sort of spotty, so I have no memory of this episode. Maybe might be worth tracking it down if it's on Hulu or something. It sounds kind of fun, a parody of Batman 66. That's kind of interesting. Little Russell Burbage, of course, from this very episode says, another great show, another great episode. Love the geekiness of the discussion on how to improve Greenback. I remember as a kid thinking he should have come back. Clearly, an air gun was a pretty powerful weapon. I wanted to add my two cents regarding the intro of the SF cartoon. I always thought that when Ted Knight was talking about the cosmic legends of the universe, that he was talking about how the whole universe was familiar with these four heroes. Kind of like how everybody in the West knew of about the Lone Ranger. At least, that's how I thought about it. That's a really interesting observation, Russell. That makes a lot more sense than what I said. I like that a lot. That those four heroes are so legendary that they're heard of all over the galaxy, all over the universe. That's cool. I like that a lot. Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for a Girl blog says, splendid show as ever. David is a great guest. I'd love a special Fire and Water Presents episode telling us more about his non-canon characters project. David, you listening? I don't think anyone mentioned it, but the first Superthon was held in Justice League of America number 114 in 1974, the Anachronus issue. It stuck in my mind because I'd never heard of a telethon. Did the TV cartoon ever follow up on Wendy and Marvin after they graduated? Rob, your solution to the cosmic legends of the universe line makes sense. Respect. Well, more respect. Well, thank you, Martin. I appreciate that. But I have to say, like I just said above with Russell, I like Russell's idea almost a lot more in some ways. So I think maybe that'll be the one I use from now on every time it comes up. And, of course, doing a Super Friends podcast means it comes up a lot. So that is going to do it for this episode of For All Mankind. Of course, you can follow the show over on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. If you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So if you want to support For All Mankind, just go over to patreon.com/FW Podcast and make a pledge, and it helps keep the network coming along. So thank you very much for that. So that is going to do it. Big thanks to Russell Burbage, my pal, my longtime pal, for stopping by and talking about this issue of Super Friends. He will definitely be back on the show later on. So that's going to do it. So thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we look at Super Friends number 7, The Warning of the Wonder Twins.
An FWTV podcast.